Okay, I think we're going to get started. Welcome everyone to this this lecture, the first day of the Binah Summer Learning Experience. There are many, many things that we've learned this year. Just think back 1 year. We've got an entirely new dictionary. I'm going to ask some people over here, if you could tell me some words or terms that you know about this year that you didn't know about a year ago. Anyone? Well, we're having some problems with the Zoom, so we'll start off with that, right? How many people knew about Zooming? Most of us, it was to Zoom meant to go somewhere quickly, right? But Zoom means something entirely different today. Everyone knows what Zoom is today. It doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are. Suddenly, this is a language. This is something that we're all aware of. Any other terms or words that you know about today that you didn't know about 365 days ago? Please, show of hands. Anything? Social distancing. Thank you. Look how we're sitting over here. I don't have my screen to be able to speak to. This is all because of social distancing, because we need to spread out in this kind of way. In fact, even little kids, ask any little kid, ask my three-year-old, ask her. She talks all the time about social distancing as well. She understands what social distancing is to some effect. Any other terms? So, Michelle, you're going to say something? Flatten the curve. Flatten the curve. What did flatten the curve mean? You should think that you're riding over a bump. You've got to flatten the curve. Something
going
else?
Huh?
Going on a diet. Oh, flattening the curve. Okay, that's what you thought it was. Anything else? Please, participate.
Herd immunity.
Herd immunity. Guys, some doctors, physicians might have heard about herd immunity, but really it wasn't something which knew a lot about. Anyone ever heard about a close contact? Or a casual contact, the difference between them. How about hand sanitization? So we knew about it, but it wasn't like part of our lexicon every single day's language. Hand sanitization. What about the term, we're in this together? We're in this together. Okay, we're all in it together. It's always like that. Unity, right? But it's not just a Jewish thing. Suddenly everyone's in it together. We're all there together. How about something like case X? Anyone ever heard of case X before? What is case X? Well, they're looking very, very much for case X by using something called contact tracing. Who'd ever heard of contact tracing? These are all terms. These are all brand new things which we hadn't heard of before. Maybe we had heard of them, but there wasn't part of our everyday language. But this is something which we've learned this year. Yes?
Unprecedented.
Unprecedented. It's just referred to generally as the unprecedented. And we know exactly what it's referring to, right? So this lecture is called, maybe should be called, The Unprecedented from a Talmudic Perspective. But it's the coronavirus from a Talmudic perspective. Now, what is this? What are we going to do over here? It's not a halachic class. We're not going to talk about the many different kind of laws. And you know what? Coronavirus has made us pay attention to so many areas and halachas that no one had ever thought about before, or they were in some obscure section in the Shulchan Aruch. For example, your school is closed, your kid's school is closed, so you're not able to send them. Well, what are my obligations with regards to fees when the place closed down? With regards to davening, spreading out porch minyanim, where people had to daven from one side where half of the minyan can see, half of them can't see. The way we've been doing Kriyas HaTorah, the reading of the Torah lately, for the last year, has been that person's not actually seeing the place, not coming up to the Biman, kissing the place where we're reading the Torah from. So those kind of laws, many, many other kind of laws have become very, very relevant. Laws like, who's first in line for a ventilator? Who's first in line for vaccinations? Should we take the vaccination? All those kind of questions, they're fascinating. And their entire sugyot, their entire pages and topics on their own, we're not going to be talking about that. What we're going to be talking about over here is, we're going to see that all these different terms that we mentioned at the outset are not actually foreign to one who studies the Talmud. They're written about in a very different kind of way, but they're not foreign concepts. So that's why it's called coronavirus or the unprecedented from a Talmudic perspective. So we're going to put on some Talmudic glasses just for a few minutes, and we're going to be able to look at some of the things that we've been experiencing over the last year or so, and or less than year even. And we're going to hopefully be able to see how these things are reflected upon in the Talmud itself. So let's start off with the way that we're sitting right here. Social distancing. You see straight away, social distancing. Now in Australia, what is social distancing? We've got to keep 1.5 meters away from each other. The definition from the New South Wales Health is as follows. Now just follow along with me. Pretend that it's a slide. Physical distancing means reducing the close physical contact we have with people and staying 1.5 meters away from people we don't live with. Important. It's people that we don't live with. We'll see this in from a Talmudic perspective as well. People living in the same household do not need to be 1.5 meters from each other. So if you're in your own household, you don't need to be 1.5 meters away from someone else. And that's why we say couples can sit together, families can stay together. Now, how far do we need to social distance from each other? Now, the numbers seem to be quite arbitrary. It depends which country you're living in. Sometimes it depends which state you're living in. So this is the piece from an article called The Conversation, which says as follows: what constitutes a safe distance when it comes to the spread of COVID-19? Well, the answer depends on where you live. China, Denmark, and France recommend social distancing of 1 meter, only 1 meter. Australia, Germany, and Italy recommend 1.5 meters, and the US recommends 6 feet or 1.8 meters. It's because no one keeps it there anyway, so you can make it as big as you want, but they recommend 1.8 meters. What we're going to see is that from a Talmudic perspective, it's not just an arbitrary number. Now, obviously, the reason that they say 1.5 or 1 because that's how far the droplets can spread, etc., etc. I don't know much about the whole topic. But I do understand that that's their basis. But we do see that it's somewhat unclear. The jury's still out there on the science as to how far you actually need to social distance even today. But let's dive into a piece in the Talmud. Talmud says as follows. It's referring to lost objects. So the Talmud says, Omer Resh Lakish, and again, if you're not able to read along, don't worry at all. Okay, this isn't a text-based shir, but I am going to be referring to many texts. So Resh Lakish says, in the name of Abba Koyen Barda, he says, Arba Amu Shel Odom Koynes Lo B'chol Mokoyen. The 4 square cubits surrounding a person has the legal status of his courtyard, and it affects acquisition of every ownerless item located there for him everywhere. My timer, what's the reason? The sages instituted this so that people would not come to quarrel over an item. This is what it means. It means that if I'm walking and you're also walking and we both spot a lost item and I say, hey, I got it first. I saw it first. And you say, no, you saw it first. Well, you know what? If it's within my 4 cubits, then it's mine. If it's within your 4 cubits, it's yours. The 4 cubits of a person around him belong to him. How much is 4 cubits? Well, a cubit, an amo is about, well, an amo is this, but it depends how tall you are. Well, generally an amo is 48 centimeters. So it comes to 4 cubits is 1.92 meters, almost the 1.8 of America. So 1.92 meters around the person is halakhically considered to be the person's space. That is your space. It doesn't belong to anyone else. When you're walking along, when you're standing over here, I shouldn't say walking. When you're standing in a place, that area around you belongs to you. And this is the ruling in the Shulchan Aruch in the bottom, text 2 in the bottom of page 1 says that the 4 amos around a person, where he's standing there, they acquire for him everything that comes into that space. It's like your property. If something would fly over your wall and land in your courtyard, it's yours. Belongs to you. So too, if something lands within your 4 cubits around you, it's yours. Because halachically, that is your space. Now, what's written over here is that the rabbis instituted that so that people should not come to fight with each other. But we're going to see that it's actually a biblical thing as well. The area belongs to you. Your aura, so to say, spreads to the area around you, and that is technically your space. I'll show you in the halacha how this is so real. But where does this work? Is this everywhere? Well, in social distancing, remember what it says in the New South Wales Health. It says that it's not in your own household. In your own household, you don't need to social distance. Well, how does it work with the 4 amos of someone? If I come into your property, if I come into your garden, can I then say something fell into my 4 amos, into my 4 amos that it belongs to me? Well, the halacha is, top of the page, on page 2 says, Bistei chaveroi eino koine. In the field of someone else, you never make an acquisition. I should take here matana liyoda. It actually needs to come into your hand. So let's just say you're standing in someone's house and something, a cricket ball comes flying over the wall. You don't know where it's come from. It's come from very far away, or it's some moon rock or whatever it is comes and lands. And you say, and your friend says, hey, it's mine because it's my property. And you say, well, it's in my dalet amos. Well, the rule is whoever's hand it reaches, that's the one. So when you're in someone else's property, it doesn't work. This is only when you are in a public space. Then the four amos rule applies. But maybe it's just something which the rabbis instituted. Just like it's something which the health authorities instituted for the purpose of coronavirus. Well, it's not so simple. How does it work with something as important as a get, for example? So the rule of a get is, the Torah says, that the man who's divorcing his wife needs to write the get, has to be written, and v'nosan b'yodo, he needs to place it into her own hand. Listen to this interesting case in the Gemara. Gemara always deals with strange, bizarre cases which are out of the ordinary. It says the Gemara in Gittin says as follows. Hoysa imedet b'rishus harabim. The woman is standing in a public domain. V'zor koi lo. And he throws it to her. Very not nice man. He throws the get to her. He doesn't want to even put it into her hand. The rule is korov lo megureshes. If it's closer to her, she's divorced. Korov lo, if it's closer to him, ain't a megureshes, she's not divorced. Now, what is the definition of being closer? Think about it. It didn't actually reach her hand. It just came close to her. Says the Gemara. The Gemara clarifies and says, well, what is it? Says, what is considered closer to her? What is considered closer to him? Rav says, Rav, one of the great teachers in the Talmud, says, if it fell within 4 cubits of her, this is what's meant by the Mishnah statement, it's closer to her. If it's within her 4 cubits, it's as if it reached her hand, because that is her property. That belongs to her biblically. If it fell within 4 cubits of him, this is what meant by closer to him. Well, he threw it, but he had a very bad throw, and it just like came back right over here, so that it hasn't left his hand. Your hand is the 4 cubits around you. You own the 4 amas around you. Now this number, yes?
If the distance is less than 4 cubits between the woman and the man.
Sorry, if there's?
If the distance between the man
and then there's no, then it's a doubt. Then it's a sophic. It's not a clear divorce then. But the idea what we're bringing across is that this 4 amas concept is a real biblical concept. With regards to lost items, so the rabbis decided to implement the biblical concept so that if something falls into your 4 amas, I mean, you're in a public space, that will become yours. Now, this is not just an arbitrary number that they decided, just like some health authorities decided on 1 meter, others decided on 1.2, 1.5, 1.8. This is a very precise kind of thing. The Talmud teaches this. The Talmud says, Vahani arba amas, these 4 amas, heichok siva. There's a Talmud in Eiruvin Amun, text 4, on page 2. The Gemara says, the 4 cubits, where are they written about in the Torah? I'm open the Torah, I don't find anything written about arba amas, about 4 amas. It says, kidetanya, because the Braisa, we understand. It says as follows, Shivu ish tachtov. When Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Jewish people in the desert about the very first Shabbos, he tells them, every day you're going to go out and collect the mon. However, on the day of Shabbos, Shavu Ishtachtov, remain every man in his place. What is the place of a person? Kama Tachtov. Well, what is the place of the person? Well, the Gemara says, Gufoi Sholosh Amos. The body of a person is 3 amos. Va'amo kedai lifshot yodo v'raglov. And then he gets an extra amo to be able to stretch his arms and to be able to stretch his legs. So it adds up to an extra amo. How do we know, by the way, that people were 3 amos high? We know that if you go in Israel and you see some of what they call the kuchim, which is the different burial sites, and where they would bury people in caves in the walls of hills, they were generally 3 amos in their length. So we know that people were that height. So we understand 3 amos is the height of a person. Plus, you're given an extra amma to be able to stretch your arms, to be able to stretch your legs, umaniach tachas mirashosov, and to be able to put it on your head. That gives us the 4 amos. Now, Kabbalah and Chassidus has got a lot to say on this. Again, it's not just an arbitrary thing. It happens to me, the person is 3 amos, and he gets an extra amma. So, the Lubavitcher Rebbe explains in a famous piece, this is in text 5, and I haven't got the translation over here. He says as follows, just very briefly. He says, we know that a person's soul is comprised of 4 main levels. 4 levels of the soul. The one is called nefesh, ruach, neshama, and chaya. Now, there's a big difference between them. The difference is nefesh, ruach, and neshama are 3 levels of the soul, which are what we call kochos pnimim. They are more internal within the person. The level of chaya is a level which we call a koyach makif. It's something which is more all-encompassing. It's not for here and now to go into it. But the idea is, he says, this fits into what the Talmud says. There are the three parts of the soul, which is the person himself, is three amas, nefesh, ruach, and neshava. And then you've got the one, in order to stretch his hands and legs and to be able to put his hands on top of his head, that represents something which is like a kippah, something which is makif, something which encompasses a person on the top. So each amah, each cubit, refers to one of those kochas hanefesh, one of those powers of the soul. So the idea of four amas is something halachic. We see it from Gittin with regards to divorce. We see it when it comes to lost object. We see that it's different when you're in someone else's property, just like we saw from New South Wales Health, that you don't need a social distance when you're in your own house. We're not talking about someone else's house over here. Again, not everything compares exactly. It's just the principles, the perspective. Now, is there a difference between staying still or walking? Now, if you go and you research it, you'll see that in March, April, May, again, when they were just trying to understand, they are still trying to understand exactly how these things work, and the science is changing all the time. There's a debate in the different health guidelines regarding this. Is it only when you're staying still, that's when you have to have your 1.5? But if I'm just walking past someone and he's walking past me, do I also need a social distance? Now, most people will tell you, as a precaution, yes, when you're jogging, stay away and keep away, whatever it is. But it's not always so clear. So let's look how it is in halacha. The dalad amos, the four cubits of a person that acquires anything that falls within those four cubits, is it only if I'm standing still? What happens if I'm walking and I suddenly something comes, falls into my four cubits? Would that have the same din? Would the law be the same in that kind of situation? So actually, there's a dispute. The same way that in the health guidelines there are disputes, so too, there's a dispute. And this is what the Torah writes, top of page 3. It says, for Kosav HaRavid, the Ravid says, Shalo Tiknu Dalad Amos. The Ravid was one of the great Rishonim, early writers. He says, this concept of four amos, that the four amos of the person acquire for him, that only that is only regarding Ella Ba'oime. That's only if you're standing still. Avo B'mahalech Loi. But if you're walking, no. You don't get your four amos around you because you are not stationary. You're moving about. He says, V'adoni Ovi Arosh Dao. Hoya Oime Sha'ain Chilok. Whereas my father, the Rosh, said, who was the great father of Ashkenazic law, he said, there is no difference. Doesn't matter. Whether you walk still or if you're walking, you've got a social distance because you keep your area around you, your four amas belongs to you. Again, he's not talking about social distancing. We're not comparing the two to each other. It's just a perspective. In fact, the CDC guidelines in America says that outdoor activities such as running are fine to continue doing, even in the case of a shelter-in-place mandate, as long as you stay socially distanced from others and avoid groups. So they're saying that you should still go like the Rosh and say that your area around you, your four amas around you, or your 1 point, in their case, just a bit less than four amas, 1.8 meters around you, 6 feet, keep to that area even when you're moving. So that's the one thing in our lexicon, social distancing. Let's talk about hand sanitizing. So this is something I would have loved to show you, but I'd recommend that you go onto YouTube and you see this. In about April or May, there was a person, he's a famous YouTuber, he's actually worked for NASA for many years, his name is Mark Rober. He's got some very interesting scientific experiments and things like that. And he did an experiment. He wanted to show how the virus spreads on surfaces. He did an experiment with school children. It's about 4 minutes. You can see the clip. With school children and the teacher. He put this, something which is called glow germ, which is it's a kind of a powder. He put it onto the hand of one teacher and one child at the beginning of the day. It's something which you cannot see at all. However, with a special ultraviolet light, you're able to see it. Onto the hand of one teacher and one student. And he told all the kids, and the teachers told the kids, you must wash your hands constantly throughout the day. Continue to wash your hands throughout the day. By the first recess, it was absolutely everywhere. Everywhere. And this was his conclusion. He said as follows. The light revealed powder had made its way onto the floor, door handles, desks, sinks, the phone, and other children's hands and faces, even though they were diligent about washing them. The UV light showed that it's not just children who touch their faces either. The teacher glow germ powder light up all her forehead, nose and chin to, even though she was aware of it and she knew about this experiment. On average, we touch our face. He says he has this whole scientific thing to work it out. We touch our face 16 times an hour. I bet there's someone touching their face right now, right? Which is why washing hands is so important. It is impossible to catch a virus directly through your hands. The problem is we use our hands to help the virus out by constantly giving it a ride. So that's how it is. We understand that our hands, without us being even consciously aware of it, are always busy and always moving. Now, this is something which is not foreign to Yiddishkeit in any way whatsoever. We are always washing our hands. We're obsessed with washing our hands. In fact, in the time of the Black Death, there was this claim that the Jews were the ones who were poisoning the wells. And one of the reasons was because there were less Jews dying than others. Well, more Jews died because of that anti-Semitism itself, because of that claim. But it was partially right. It's very simple. It's because the average guy in the Middle Ages was washing his hands maybe once every 6 months. The Jews are washing their hands every couple of hours. Every time you go to the bathroom, you have to wash your hands. Every time before you eat, you wash your hands. We have this concept of mikvah. We're always washing ourselves. You have to wash before Shabbos. All these kind of things. But washing our hands is something which we have. Why do we wash our hands in the morning? Why do we wash our hands? The most technical reason, without getting into any spiritual reason. Why do we wash our hands in the morning? Why do we wash our hands before bread? Let's look at what the Gemara tells us. It says, Kimasha Yodeh. He says, when a person washes his hands in the morning, he makes the bracha, leimam, and tech six. He says, Baruch Hashem Kedishonim, Mitzvah V'Tzivonu, Al Netilas Yadayim, blessed are you Hashem, who has commanded us for the washing of our hands. Kimoshi Ape, when he washes his face, he says, Baruch Hashem V'Chev L'Shedem, Eina Usnum Ha'Maf Ha'Poy. Then he says, thank you Hashem for removing sleep from my eyes, etc. The Rosh there comments, and he says, why do we wash our hands in the morning? The reason is, the fish Yodav Sho'odam Asconi Yoyshaim. Remember that word. The hands of a person are very busy. They're busy even without you realizing how busy they are. There's the involuntary muscles in the hands are very, very strong. They're always working. And it's impossible that your hands are not touching your a part of your flesh which should be covered in the nighttime. You can't say that you didn't touch flesh, which is usually covered up, for which you need to wash your hands in order to be able to say brachos. That's why we wash our hands in the morning. Similar thing when it comes to the most common Jewish practice. Ask any Jew, what do we do before we eat bread? We go and we, it depends where, if you're from South Africa, then you go and you vas. If you're from other places, you wash your hands. But we wash our hands. What's the reason that we wash our hands? We're going to get into this in a moment. But the basic understanding reason is the Chachamim, the sages, said that we've got to assume that your hands have touched something impure. Again, it's not so relevant today. We're going to get into purity and impurity in a moment. But the reason was, this is what the Rambam writes. The Rambam says, Shloim HaMelech hu Beis Din. It was Shloim HaMelech and his Beis Din. Gozru akoh hayadayim shiyu shniyos. They said that all hands of a person should be second level of impurity. We'll explain that in a moment. Even if you don't know that your hands touched something impure, they're still impure. Reason? Your hands are always busy. Always busy. That's the reason why if you get up from your meal to go do something else, if it's something completely different, you've got to go and wash your hands again. Because even if you say, I didn't touch anything impure, I didn't touch anything else, it's assumed that without you even knowing, you probably did. Just like we touched our faces over here. Well, half an hour's gone by, so we probably touched our faces 8 times within the last half an hour without even realizing it. But that's what happens. Our hands are busy. We realize that. So all these conclusions of this experiment and many other experiments as to how many times people are touching things and how kids are touching things, where adults are the exact same. We're always, our hands are always busy. We're always touching things. But on this point, this is a good segue into the spread of the virus itself. How the virus spreads. So, when you study Talmud, if you get to a section which goes into the laws of purity and impurity, it is a great way to get people to immediately switch off. Because it's like things which are so foreign and things which make very little sense, but a lot of the Talmud is concentrated on it. Now, tumah, ritual impurity, the kind which we don't have today. Ritual impurity was a major part of Jewish life in the past. So much so, if you go to Eretz Yisrael, if you go to Israel, and you want to know where it was that Jews lived, only one thing you need to look for. And you'll find them absolutely everywhere in Israel. That's a mikveh. Mikveh was for everyone. In fact, I've been to places in Israel where you see every single home, every single one has a mikveh. There's no other religions which have mikvahs built in the same way as ours. You know the Jews lived over there, and someone comes and claims that it's their country and that they've been there all the time. Well, why did they have these funny kind of baths which were going down steps in their houses? It didn't work like that. The reason was because mikveh and being pure was something which is very important, particularly if you were a kohen. Today, to be a kohen is a great thing. Kohen, you get to get the first aliyah, and you can bench first and do other things. A kohen carried with it a lot of weight, because you had to be able to be ritually pure. Now, just like the virus. Now, impurity, purity and impurity is not a virus in any way whatsoever. It's a biblical thing which we don't understand. We know how it works, but we can't see it. And that's the comparison with a virus. Just like the virus, it's not visible. You won't see it at all. Let's look at one of those sections in the Torah, and we'll learn just for a few minutes some of the laws of purity and impurity. And suddenly some of the terms like contact tracing and the terms like a casual contact and a close contact and all that suddenly becomes very, very real and makes a lot of sense. So the Torah tells us, let's just read it in the English. Torah tells us, whoever touches the body, this is a Torah Parshas Vayikra, it says, whoever touches the body of the one with discharge shall wash his clothes. We're talking about a person, male or female, who had a discharge from their body which could cause them to become impure. It's called Zov. And if the person had this discharge, whoever touches the body of the one with the discharge shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, and remain unclean until evening. Okay, so imagine let's just replace all these tumah and tarup things with coronavirus. So the person who had the virus, I mean, you see these guys coming in huge hazmat suits to get rid of everything. You think they don't wash the clothes, they get rid of clothes as well. If one with a discharge spits on one who is clean, so then the latter shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, and remain unclean until evening. For sure, spit is the best way to transfer a virus in any of these things. Any means for riding that one with a discharge has mounted shall be unclean. Whoever touches anything that was under him shall be unclean until evening. Whoever carries such things shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, remain unclean until evening. If one with a discharge without having rinsed his hands in water, now when it says rinsing hands in water means going to the mikveh, touches another person, that person now becomes unclean himself, right? Because he spread the virus by touching. That person, he didn't social distance, he didn't do what he was meant to do. So then, that person shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, and remain unclean until evening. An earthen vessel that one with a discharge touches shall be broken. Any wooden implement should be rinsed with water. This is some of the Torah telling us about the laws of ritual purity and impurity. There's a lot in the Torah. Very often, when we get to that section in the Torah, our minds just switch off because it's like, so I want to learn about practical stuff. This is like not practical at all. It's very interesting. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I want to explain to you a little bit, very, very briefly, about the levels of Tumah and how it works. Talmud is full of this. It really is. In fact, there's an entire order of the Talmud. I'm not talking about one tractate. I'm not talking about one section. I'm talking about many tractates which just talk about this topic, about purity and impurity. For us, it's difficult, but they say that there were days when every child from Dan to Be'er Sheva, from the north to the south of Israel, was proficient in all these laws. So how does it work? So the way it works, again, I'm not going to spend much time on this at all. I don't want to bore you. So you've got, I'm on the bottom of page 4. You've got the father of Tumah. It's called Av HaTumah. That means the source. I'm not talking about the top one. The top one is the corpse itself. I'm talking about the father of Tumah, which means a dead moving creature, a dead animal, a Zov, a Metzorah, all these kind of people. This is the source of the impurity. Now the source of the impurity touches anything, as we just read in the Psukim, touches anything, has contact with anyone, anything, that thing becomes impure as well. However, this is the way that it works. The person who becomes impure, the object that becomes impure, doesn't become impure at the same level of the first one. It gets condensed, it goes down. That first one to contract the tumah is called a rishon. Rishon is what we refer to as first degree of tumah. Now, the first degree of Tumah cannot make anything into Tomei. If that first degree, so that person who touched the source, That person is called the Rishon. If he touches, he or she touches food, the food and liquids is a whole different discussion, but touches food, that food is now Tomei, is impure. And by the way, the Torah has severe penalties for someone who eats things which are impure. Well, for general people, it's not a problem at all, but for people like a Kohen, or to eat the Truma, which is impure, it carries quite a penalty. So it was very important for them to know exactly what stage something was. So that's called the Rishon. Now, the food that the person touched is called a Sheni. Sheni is second degree Tuma. That's the second degree. Here's the thing. Most things, for most purposes, it only goes up to the second degree. So you got the sauce. Sauce touched first thing, that's called first degree. First degree touched the second thing, which is food. Not anything, touched food. That food is now no good. You can't have it. You can't eat it. That's called, it's tome. It's actually called posel. However, the way it works is that the holier or the more delicate an item is, the more susceptible it is to tumah. So what happens is, you've got something which is called ordinary food. That's called chulin. That's what we've spoken about until now. I haven't mentioned anything else. Then there's something which is called terumah. Terumah is special tithes that have been given to the kohen. Only a kohen is allowed to eat that. Now here's the way that it works. Is that thing which is second degree. So again, you've got object number one. Usually when I teach this kind of thing in the Talmud, we've got a lot of different objects and we label them. So this is the source. Then you've got like a source, like a dead rodent or something like that. Source. Then you've got number one. Then it goes to number two. Usually it's finished over there. Number two touches something else, doesn't make it impure at all. However, if that next item is teruma, then it does make it bad. You can't have it. Why? Because teruma is so holy, it's more susceptible. It's more vulnerable and susceptible to that tuma, to that impurity. And that's where it ends for teruma. If that touches another teruma, doesn't make it into a problem. Is everyone with me? The last step on the whole thing is something which we call kodshim. Kodshim are the meats from a sacrifice. That's the holiest thing you can possibly have. That's the holiest level. It's so holy that it can even be made impure at the fourth level. So again, source of the tumah. It's called the av hatumah. He goes and that impurifies level number one, called the Rishon. The Rishon, first degree, to a Sheni. Ends over there for regular things. But then if you've got Truma over here, it will make the Truma into level number three. If the Truma now goes and touches any food, no one do anything to it. The Truma is called Posel. It's not called Tome. We'll explain that in a moment. Posel means it's a problem on its own, but it won't affect others. But if that fourth thing is Kochim, is the meat of a sacrifice, then it will make it impure even at the fourth level because it's so holy, therefore it's so much more susceptible to tumah, to impurity. Now that is something which is completely irrelevant for us today. But I will tell you something quite interesting, and that is, back in the day, it was crucial for them to know whether an impure person had been in close contact, had touched something, or it touched something that had touched something. It was always important to know what level it was. So the Talmud is full of stories of what we would today call contact tracing. Exactly that. They were trying to ascertain, trying to work out, well, hold on a second, was the person? But we don't know. Did the person come over here? Didn't come over here? But the person came and he was leaning on this, so it must be that thing becomes a Sheni. But then the person brought in Truma, that becomes number three. We're always trying to work out, and the many principles that they use. If it's in a private domain, so then if you're in doubt, then you're going to make it impure. If it's in a public domain, then you can make it pure. All these kind of things. Why? Because they're always trying to work out. I don't know if they didn't have any of these. They didn't have the COVID app or anything like that. But there were definitely the concept of working out who touched who was where, who went where. Did he go through this path or he came through this path? There's entire sections in the Talmud called Shnei Shvilim. Person worked through this path and we know there was someone impure over there. We don't know where he went there. We don't know. There were two people went through the two paths. One is pure, one's impure. Do we say the pure person went through the pure path and the impure one through the impure path? Or do we not say that? This was something which was part of the way that they lived. So that's all something which is very far in the past. Let's make it a little bit more relevant. Let's just replace, and turning to page 5, in 2020 COVID language, let's just replace some of these first degree, second degree, third degree. Let's just replace it for some of the terms that we already know about. So what's the difference between a casual and a close contact? Here's the definition from New South Wales Health. A casual contact is someone who has been near a confirmed case of COVID-19 while they were infectious, but has been assessed as lower risk than a close contact. Some casual contacts, however, may have a higher risk of infection associated with an exposure. These people are asked to get tested immediately and isolate until a negative test result is received. People with a lower risk are only asked to monitor for symptoms. Now, let's just translate that into exactly what we learned about. The different levels. Father of Tuma. The father of the Tuma in COVID language will be the person with COVID. The person with COVID is the source, also known as case X. They're looking for case X. They still haven't found case X. So important, because you have to know where it came from. You need to know who's the first person who brought it in. That's what you need to understand. The first degree will be the close contact. The second degree will be a casual contact. Not as much as the first degree, but it's a little bit lower. Now again, I do understand and know that there's a difference. With regards to tumor, we're talking about one level affecting another one. We're not saying that that the close one touched the casual one, etc. But I'm just trying to point out that are called degrees in tumor. Third degree, remember what we said. The holier and the more vulnerable that something is, the more susceptible it is to the tumor, and the more susceptible it will be to the virus. So therefore, the elderly would be like teruma. They would go to the third degree. The medically vulnerable, comorbidities, another term, by the way, never knew about a year ago, that would go onto the fourth degree. That's like coaching. And that's exactly what New South Wales Health are telling us. They're telling you that if you're a casual contact, just monitor for symptoms. However, some casual contacts, people with greater level of risk, you really have to be very, very careful, even at the casual level. Even at the third degree level, you could be affected with that. Now, how is it transmitted? Is everyone with me? Well, that was a little bit too much on Tuma and Tara. How is it transmitted? How does the virus spread? So here the virus spreads, and again, I'm not off the topic of Tuma and Tara completely. The virus spreads mainly by people in the air, but it can also possibly spread by surfaces, right? So the CDC says as follows. The primary and most important mode of transmission for COVID-19 is through close contact from person to person. Based on data from lab studies on COVID-19 and what we know about similar respiratory diseases, it may be possible that a person can get COVID-19 by touching a surface or object that has the virus on it and then touching their own mouth, nose, or possibly their eyes. But this isn't thought to be the main way the virus spreads. Now, let's just go back to the laws of Tuma and Tara. So everyone agrees that it mainly spreads through a live host who's able to hold it and also spread it further. There's something which is called a dead host. The dead host is a surface. And the jury is also out there under how much we're really careful about wiping down surfaces and all that, how much it actually spreads to surfaces. And even they say very clearly, it may be possible that you can get it that way. This is the latest that they have on their website. It may be possible, but it's not absolute at all. Why? Because the virus is there, but it's not able to spread it further. In the words of Tuma and Tara, that's what we said. There's something which is called tamay and something called pasul. Remember, something at the second degree, for example, is called posul. Posul means that it is invalid. It's a problem on its own. But it won't be able to be matame something else, to make something else impure. It stops over there. So the difference between these two could be the same. In COVID language, direct exposure to an infected person. The infected person is not just posul, not just invalid on his own, but it actually is tamay, able to spread that to someone else, versus exposure to an infected surface, which, as the science is telling us, it could spread further, but usually that is a problem on its own, but it won't spread it to the next level. That's what we would refer to as pasul. It stops over there. It's like the second level, stops over there, and doesn't go any further. By the way, this is the reason why we wash our hands before eating, because they would the koyanim who would eat their bread would have to wash their hands before eating truma, because it could be that their hands had touched certain things that they weren't aware of. And therefore, the sages said, Shlomo HaMelech said, that the hands of a person should be given constantly second degree tuma, second degree impurity, which if in the case of teruma would make it impure. But that's not for our discussion over here. Now, we mentioned COVID on surfaces. So here you'll find something quite fascinating with regards to COVID on surfaces. Which surfaces are the best for holding COVID that it could live on for a long time? Now, when it comes to tuma and tara, ritual purity and impurity, not all surfaces are the same. Certain surfaces are more susceptible and carry the tuma longer, and there's no way to fix it. Other surfaces don't carry it at all. And we find something quite similar. Look at this table. This is the item. The item is an earthenware object. According to many, glass falls into that category of earthenware object. What's the degree of tuma? It is so susceptible that even if there's no contact between the impure and the glass and the earthenware object, even from its airspace on the inside, it already becomes impure. Now, how long does the virus last? Now, jumping ahead a couple of thousand years, how long does the virus last on this particular surface? So based on the Lancet and New England Journals of Medicine, on glass it lasts for, it can sit there for up to 4 days. On plastic, which would probably fall into the same category, for 3 days. Very susceptible to hold it. Let's go down a level. Steel objects. So steel objects become tome with any contact. The whole thing is tome. How long does the virus last? 2 to 3 days if the virus comes onto the object. What about clothing? Clothing is tome with any contact at all. What they found in their studies is that the virus can last on clothing up to 2 days. Remember, this is all within under certain conditions, but it's all equal for all these objects. Wood and paper. Now, when it comes to tuma, wood is interesting. Wood is only becomes tome, only becomes ritually impure if it's got what we call a base kibbutz. It has to have a receptacle, has to have a part of itself which is able to hold something. But if it's flat, it's called pshute clay. If it's flat, it doesn't become tome. It doesn't become ritually impure. Paper and wood are at the lowest level. Even under lab conditions, it was only able to hold it paper was for 3 hours, wood was for 2 days. And so we see that there's a bit of a correlation between the susceptibility to tuma on these things and how tame they become, how impure they become, and to these other things. On the topic, handles of objects as transmitters of the disease. Now, before this year, had you ever seen this kind of sign? Keep calm and use your arm, right? Keep calm and use your arm. Or there's an invention, and actually if you go online, you'll see plenty of them. Inventions and things that people can actually have on their keyring, or things that you can have in your wallet, so you won't actually have to hold the door. I could guarantee that many people who walked into this building over here today didn't touch the door handle. I know I didn't. I've just become like that, using my arm the whole time. Using my arm, my jacket, whatever it is. We just become quite used to that. We're very careful with handles. So does the Talmud discuss handles at all? Well, you bet it does. There's an entire tractate in the Talmud which talks about the handles of objects when it comes to contracting tuma impurity. It's the last tractate of the entire Talmud. It's called Uktzin. Some say Oikotzin. Uktzin is an entire tractate, which as we see over here, I've just brought a text just to show you, from a sefer called Otsu Yisrael. He's just defining each one. He says, HaMaseches HaZois, this entire tractate, Ikro Benuya, it is all built on this, and that is Levoer Yodois V'Shomrei HaOichlin, to tell us about handles on food and peels on food. When do they become impure? When do they not come impure? When are they considered to be part of the object? When are they not considered to be part of the object? So you've got an impure apple. Well, is the stem of the apple also impure? You've got a door which is impure. Well, what about the handle? Depends how it's attached, how it's connected. Did it spread? Did it not spread? All I'm trying to point out is that it's, again, I'm not trying to correlate virus with tuma and tara, but the concept is not foreign from a Talmudic perspective. Yeah, people were very careful. I could bet you that there was an invention that they had to prevent themselves from having to open the handles. For sure they had that, because the person wants to make sure that he's not touching the handles. They probably touched, but they didn't use this metal thing, by the way, because metal conveys tuma. Remember, we said that steel is one of the highest levels. But they definitely used different kind of things. By the way, Uktzin, I'll take questions after because I know we're rushed. Uktzin was one of the toughest tractates to study. So much so, the Talmud tells us that when Rabbi Yehuda would reach the tractate of Uktzeh, and he said, this is too much. He would be able to learn everything, came to Uktzeh, and he said, this is for Abaya, this is for Rav and Shmuel, this is for the great minds, this is not for me. And like with COVID, what we find is that many find it difficult to actually define how much of the virus sits on handles of doors and how much of the virus can be spread through surfaces. We do see that kind of correlation. Now, the spread of the virus and communal responsibility, this is quite a big one. This is something which I encourage you to go and see. Go on your phones when you finish, not right now. Go on your phones after you've hand sanitized, because remember, phones is a whole sugya itself, whole topic as to how much it holds a virus, how much it doesn't. That's plastic, and it's got a glass top, and it's got this kind of thing. The truth is, phones, by the way, it's not a great carrier of the virus anyway. But this is it's called, just Google, Washington Times simulation of the virus spread. You'll see this incredible thing. Again, this is something which I would love to show you on the screen, but I've just done a few screenshots of this as it was going through. What you see is how fast it can spread without, if you don't social distance and if you don't take precautions. It's incredible. From one case, so quickly, to one, every time this one is just moving through, it's bumping into others. And this is done professionally. It's not just like some kind of one of those games, you know, like snake or one of those things. This is actually each time it bumps into others, you see how fast one affects another and that other affects others as well. So number one has actually affected number three, and number three has affected number 10, and all that's the way that it spreads. Exponentially, it grows. Compounded. That's exactly how it is. And you see how with time, with just a small amount of time, how quickly it jumps from 97 to 161. If you see the time lapse, the curve of the time, just on the top of it. It's something which is incredible. We understand that interest works that way, but it's just to see how fast such a thing spreads is quite fascinating. So I'm responsible for that person. That person is responsible for someone else. So am I, in effect, really responsible? A is responsible for B. B is responsible for C. So in effect, A is actually responsible for C and for D and for E and for everyone else as well. It's not just I'm responsible for you. I'm responsible for those who you are responsible for. Because that's the way that it spread. It spread so much. Now again, there's fascinating halachic discussions about someone who goes and affects other people. Someone who wasn't careful with isolation, was meant to be isolated, didn't isolate, went and affected other people. When it comes to the laws of damages and all things like that, that's a great topic for summer learning. Maybe next year, after the whole virus is all finished, we'll talk about that. Great, great discussion. But over here we see how it spread. I want to bring two Talmudic sources just to show you this concept. Amazing concept. This piece of the Talmud, text 11, the context over here is the laws of property ownership. Now here's this topic. There's this concept in the Talmud which is called, which still law still exists on this, and that is this concept of chazaka. Chazaka means assumed ownership. Assumed ownership means that if I'm living on a place, and I've been living there, it depends on the kind of place, I'm living here for 3 years, and you don't say a word to me about it, you can't come along after 3 years and say, hey, that's mine. Staying on a place for a certain amount of time is assumed ownership. What you need to do is that you have to make a mechah. You need to make a protest. You need to come to me and say, it's not yours. You need to make the protest and say, it's not yours. And then it's not assumed that it's mine. And the Talmud discusses this at great length, which is, again, possession of something is assumed ownership as long as no one else is protesting against it. Now here you've got an interesting situation which the Talmud discusses. I'll read it just in the English. If the one lodging the protest, now the guy sitting on the property is a big bully. So the person who's lodging the protest is a little bit scared of him. So he comes along and he says, do not tell the possessor of the protest. What is the halacha? He comes along and he says, I don't want you to tell him that I'm protesting. What's the halacha? So Rav Zvid said, well, it's not a valid protest. You haven't protested because he doesn't even know that you're protesting against him. Rav Papa disagreed. Rav Papa said that all that he meant, that the owner merely meant, he says to two people, don't tell him personally, but tell others. Because by you telling others, it will spread to others, and from those others, it will spread to others as well. In the words of the Talmud, chavroch, chavro islay, which means that he says to I'm telling you, I want the guy to know, but I don't want to tell him directly. I'm a little scared of him. So I'm telling you, don't go and tell him. You just go, because I know that you have a friend. Chavroch, your friend, chavro islay, he has a friend. V'chavro de chavroch, and the friend of your friend, chavro islay, he's also got a friend. Which means, if I tell you something, I know that it's going to go not from you to your friend, and from his friend to his friend. Things spread in that kind of way. I'll give you another source, which is precisely on this thing. We have this concept that Kol Yisrael, we're going to go for another 2 minutes. Kol Yisrael Arevin Zebozeh. Jewish people are all responsible for each other. By the way, that's not just a feel-good kind of statement. It's a halachic thing. It's as long as you haven't fulfilled your halachic obligations, I haven't either. That's why, even if I have heard Kiddush, I can make Kiddush for you. Why is that? Because you not having heard Kiddush, it's as if I haven't heard Kiddush. Because we're all responsible for each other. I am missing something if you are missing something. That's the way that it works. Now here comes a fascinating thing. The Jewish people, before they went into Eretz Yisrael, they had to make a covenant. Hashem made a bris with them. A covenant on all the mitzvahs. Hashem said to them, you have to keep all the mitzvahs. Now there's an interesting dispute in the Talmud. Every single Jew is responsible for all the mitzvahs, 613. But it's not just 613. It's also 613 of every single other Jew as well. Because I've got to ensure that you keep all the mitzvahs as well. Listen to this interesting piece in the Talmud. Talmud comes along, it's reading in page 9. Rabbi Huda Nossi says, according to the middle of the page, according to the statement of Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda Ish Kvar Akko, who spoke in the name of Rabbi Shimon, there's no mitzvah in the Torah for which 48 covenants were not established 603,000 times, 603,550 times. It follows that for every one of the Jewish people, there were 603,550 covenants. The Gemara says, what does he actually mean? That's already been stated beforehand in this piece. And he says the difference is, arvo v'arvo d'arvo ikobeinayu. The matter of a guarantor and a guarantor for a guarantor is the difference between them. Which means, let's just read it over here. According to Rabbi Huda Nossi, every Jew is not only rendered a guarantor for every other Jew. It's not that I have got 603,000. Remember, that's the amount of Jews that were before they went into Israel. 603,550, or now 14 million. I've got 14 million. I've got a covenant on 14 million people times 613, all their mitzvahs. But he's also rendered a guarantor for every other Jew's responsibility as a guarantor. I'm not only responsible for 603,000, for 14 million. I'm responsible for the 14 million times the 14 million on each one. The exponential, the X 3, 4, whatever it is. The exponential power of that. Therefore, according to his calculation, the number of covenants is multiplied again by 603,550. What does it say over here? I, as a Jew, am responsible not only for what you're responsible for. I'm responsible. Well, I'm not only responsible for that you should keep your mitzvahs. I'm responsible for what you are responsible for as well. Let's go back to COVID language. If I go, chas v'shalom, and spread a virus to one person, it's not about all those people. It's about who those people are going and affecting afterwards as well. That's what you see in the simulation. The one affects another, and that one then goes and affects more and more and more and more. And that's what we call arvo de arvo, responsibility for responsibility. The famous words of the Medrash, number 13, I'm just going to say it outside. The Medrash tells us that if you've got a man who's sitting in a boat, and he's sitting in his room in his cabin in the boat, and he goes and he decides that, you know what, he wants to play around, and he takes his hammer and he starts to make a hole in the floor on the boat. And people come running into the room and they say to him, what on earth are you doing over here? And he says, it's my cabin, I pay for the space, I'm allowed to go and make a hole. And they say to him, well, if you go down, we're all going down. It's not your own boat. We're all in this together. So really, we are all in it together. And I want to finish off with, if you just think about this for a second, this again is a whole topic of its own, lessons that we've taken from COVID, which was not the topic over here. But just to think about what the actions of what one person can cause, the power of the individual. So it's a little bit controversial, perhaps, how the virus started. Some say it's one person eating a bat, one person eating a pagoda, whatever it is. But what we see very clearly is, think about Victoria. Think about what's happened now in the north. One case breaks out, and look what happens. Just what, look at what one person can cause. Look what this all starts with one. One comes in, and it spreads, and it spreads, and it spreads, and it spreads. It's the power of the individual. One individual can cause an entire state, an entire country to be locked down, and can cause so many people to go out of a livelihood, and can cause so much disruption to so many people's lives for the bad. Imagine for the good. And that's why I want to finish off with the words of the Rambam, where the Rambam says as follows, very famously, in the Laws of Tshuva, the Rambam says, it is therefore necessary, says the Rambam, every individual needs to look at himself all the time as evenly balanced between innocence and guilt. And the whole world is also like that. Chota, the whole world is literally hanging in the balance. Chota chait echad. If he did one sin, think about it. He walked outside when he was infected. He commits one sin, he will overbalance himself and the whole world to the side of guilt and be a cause for its destruction. Also mitzvah achas. If he did one mitzvah, then he turns over, he overbalances himself and the whole world to the side of virtue. And he brings about his own and their salvation and their escape. We'll finish off with that. And Mitzvah Hashem, we should come out of this very, very strong. We should learn a lot from it. And the whole world should have real Yeshua v'Hatzolah, real saving. We should be overbalanced for the great salvation of the coming of Mashiach.